What we'll do is try to look at some of the principles of interpreting Revelation. But the important thing I wanted to get over to you in Revelation is the structure. Once you've seen the structure, I think you'll be amazed what a neat and tidy and organized and developed book it is, as it goes from one logical step to the next logical step. It's the most clearly defined book, I would suggest, in the whole of the Bible. And yet people just go and they grab bits out of here and they take another bit out of there and throw it all together and make a real old mishmash of the whole thing. And some of the structures that people have found there are not structures at all. They're just confusions, because the book is so simply developed right from beginning to end. If we ever get anywhere there, it'd be very surprising. But look at the back, schools of interpretation of the book of Revelation. There are four major schools, and there is a fifth school, which is the ichthus, or the gestation, or the forsterized view. That comes as part E. You will see that in a moment. It seeks to get the best of all worlds. The preterist view simply means that we interpret the book in the context of the first century Roman conditions of the Roman Empire and its persecution, first of all under Nero. Other people would also go on to the Emperor Domitian at the end of the first century. But as you will see, as we go through these notes very quickly, that I generally want to emphasize the Neronian persecution is the background, a historical event that is the interpretation for the book of Revelation. That is called the preterist view, and you can see that you can see that view summed up in the word letter or epistle. Because it says in the beginning of Revelation, write these things to the churches. Now, if it's a letter, it belongs to the era in which it was written, and if it was received in the first century, then the preterist view has a lot to be said for it, because the Bible itself says it's an epistle written in the first century to first century churches. But there is also what is called the historicist view. The historicist view is perhaps the least, I would say, popular. Well, it is popular, but it's the least convincing. But there is a very good, as you will see later, reason for looking at it, because it does help us to interpret. The historicist view gratuitously assumes that from the beginning of Revelation through to chapter 22, we have a whole panorama of church history. I say it's rather gratuitous because the Bible, it doesn't give a lot of indication that this view holds very much water. In fact, the first book, I think I must have told you before, that I ever read on the book of Revelation, said that by the time you get to chapter 9, is it, with the stings in the tails of the scorpions, in chapter 9, you've got as far as the 14th, 15th century, where the Turks are coming in and they've got cannons. And those cannons are pulled by horses, and the cannons shoot out backwards. And what the poor horses did, they'd have been shot into the next year, or the way that if that was the case. But these are supposed to be the Turkish cannons. The next commentary I read on Revelations, using the historicist view, said that it wasn't that at all. You were actually in the 20th century. And it's by the time you got there. In the 20th century, you've got Mussolini's planes, who had air gunners, who shot out backwards. It was a suicide position to fight from, but they did have such planes in the days of just before the Second World War. And Mussolini's planes went into Abyssinia, and you've got all this revelation coming out there, and they find all sorts of wonderful historical views there. But the best one was when I read a commentary that suggested that you were actually in the 18th century when you got to the 9th chapter, and the 18th century, that the stings in the tails of the scorpions were Methodist class leaders. Well, that's an interesting one to go by. So there you are. You can choose what you like. The fact is, I will try to resurrect a little bit of reason for the historicist view by the time we get to the end. But that view, it has caused a lot of confusion, and really it's just saying that God knows everything that's going to happen in every single detail, and this is what it's all going to look like. and you have to squeeze and push, and of course it keeps getting longer and longer because the Lord hasn't come back yet, and it's pretty obvious you get to the end when you get to chapter 19 onwards. So, you know, you've got to squeeze everything in, and as the more it goes on. So that's the historicist view, the whole panorama of church history, and you could say that that perhaps belongs to the word book or scroll, which is used in chapter 1, verse 11. Then there's the futurist view. There's a lot more to be said about the futurist view. It's telling us the end time events. It's not telling us the whole of church history. It's not just majoring on the first century as though it's an epistle, like Paul wrote to Timothy in the first century. This is a view which is giving us real, predictive revelation of the future, and the futurist view is very literal as you could be. You see, the historicist view, you're interpreting stings and the tails of the scorpions in a very metaphorical sense. When it comes to the futurist view, you are trying to be as literal as possible. And there's a lot to be said for the futurist view, and there are lots of good books on that. People like sober commentators like George Eldon Ladd and folk like that have written very rightly and clearly about it all. So that's all for the last phase of church history, probably the last 7 years only, maybe the last 3.5. But that period is the prophetic view, and you can see it is a prophecy because it calls itself a prophecy. So the word prophecy is used in chapter 1, verse 3. And this is the prophecy concerning the end of the age. The spiritual view says that it's not a book that only applies to the end time. So what use is that for us? It's not only a book that was written in the first century, so it's of antiquarian interest, but nothing particularly practical now. It isn't just a view which has stretched out church history, because we're not quite sure where we are in church history. It's a book that's showing us the spiritual principles of God's dealings with mankind, how God is governing the world, and how he is bringing his purposes to pass. These are the spiritual principles. And the spiritual principles is a very useful way. Hendrickson writes a very good commentary based on this particular viewpoint. And you interpret everything as parables. And it's not too far off the case because it's called an apocalypse. It's called a revelation. This is the revelation that God gave, Jesus Christ, who communicated it to his servant John through the angel. So I picked out those four words. They're all there in the book of Revelation, and each one applies in a sense particularly to a different viewpoint. Now, roll all those A to D views together: preterist, historicist, futurist, and then spiritual view. And you get what I'm calling the gestation view. Using all those four views, you can see that there is a value in getting to the understanding of what this book is saying to us by using every one of the schools. The four views come together. I call it gestation, and you could compare it to this. When the ovum is fertilized by the seed, you've got everything, that's why we are pro-life, we've got everything in that germinated egg, in that ovum, that is going to be there in a sense, in principle, on your dying day, when you are 90 years of age and deciding to plop up your clogs, going to clog up your plobs. And it's the same person all the way through. But when you do pop up your clogs, then you are actually, that is the futurist view. That is the future being fulfilled. So what was seeded in the first century, that is the kingdom and God's reign over the earth, is getting more and more near to the point of birth. And when the birth takes place, of course it is more literal, because now what was hidden in the womb of the mother is about to appear, and you can see it. and therefore it's the most literal, if you like, approaches, and that is the futurist view. But en route, you might get one or two rumblings and feelings that very soon the baby's going to be born, and that then it dies down again. You can even have false births, labour pains, and I took Faith into hospital at 8 months because she was having some pains, and they had to send us out again. And so you do get those little premonitions, and every now and again you get a premonition. It wasn't foolish to identify the Antichrist with Napoleon. It wasn't foolish to identify the Antichrist with Hitler. It wasn't foolish to Saddam Hussein to be identified. It was that these are reflections throughout history of world rulers, and they all look the same in the end. They all have their same kind of characteristics. They are despots, and they must have their will done. And that kind of person is depicted in the Antichrist, who will be the last world ruler. The historicist view, sometimes you can compare it like dropping a stone in a pond, and you get the wavelets start off, and they haven't reached the edge of the pond yet, they're still going, and then eventually when they hit the end, this good news preached in all the world, then the end shall come, is because the whole pond now has been rippled, and therefore those ripples en route all have a kind of bearing on understanding the next ripple and the next ripple and the next ripple. So there is a sense in which the historicist view, as I say, can be rehabilitated, and we can learn from events in history as to how God is at work and when God is working something out. It's fascinating that whenever a revival takes place, second coming teaching comes to view, and people start talking about the second coming. When the revival dies down, people stop talking about the second coming, and so the two things go hand in hand as one works towards the other. So the gestation view is looking, and of course the principles that run from the conception to the birth of the child, running right the way through, those principles are the same right the way through its growth. It doesn't get born as an alligator or a dinosaur. It gets born, if it's a human being, as a human being. There was a controlling principle running right the way through all the events of the changing embryo inside the mother's womb. Now, those bring all those different views together. Now, I want to just look at it from the point of view of the types of way in which we interpret. So I've called this the nature of the book of Revelation. The preterist view is very much the historical critical method, that principle of interpretation. The preterist view is saying, what did it say and what did it mean then when it was written in the context of the first century? But that's only the beginning of interpretation, but it is a beginning. And if we depart from that discipline of the historic critical interpretation, we will soon go wild about anything. You know, you can go off and, well, as people do, make all sorts of interpretations of Revelation. Wonderful things in the scriptures I see, some put there by you, some put there by me. That kind of thing begins to happen as people have no, parameters for their imagination. So the historical critical method emphasizes the preterist view. The historical method, I would say, is like the Jewish Midrash. I've explained the ripple effect. The Jews easily apply their scriptures into different situations of history. It's the same things happening again. You get it quite obviously in a big one like they came out of the Exodus. Now they're coming out of the exile, and they're paralleled events, and it's just the same thing that's happening again in history. Or Abraham had to come over the flood, just as Israel had to come out of Egypt and through the flood, and how you go through the Jordan to get into the promised land, and so on. These, as it were, motifs keep repeating themselves, and that is a very popular Jewish way of using the scriptures in understanding what's going on in their history. The third view, the futurist view, is the one which, again, as I say, is the being as literal as possible. Now, you can't be totally literal. No, I think I've gone to you before about language isn't literal anyway. Language is just making a consensus of acceptance of a certain noise means a certain thing. And that's how language develops and is useful, and how we can communicate and give concepts to one another. But bearing in mind that, again, you need the discipline of what it actually does say, what the metaphor really is, then you're in the place where you can get some sort of decent interpretation. And the literalist view can't be totally literal, though, as a futurist view, I should say. It's got to be a view which is, in some way or other, is applying language in the way it's always intended. There's a man walking down the road outside the house there, and he's got a lion's heart. You know very well he hasn't got a literal lion's heart. He hasn't had a heart transplant. You know what I'm saying. And in one sense, yes, it's literal. He's walking down the road. But it's not literal that he has a literal man's heart. So a lot of this business of do you interpret the Bible literally or not is meaningless. Do you interpret it and understand it in the way that it was intended, on the way in which the Spirit of God intends it? Not just the way even that the author intended it, because the Spirit of God, when he uses an author, sometimes is intending it something more. That's what Peter says in the beginning of his epistle. So that's the third aspect of. And then the spiritual view is more or less the rabbinic, the parabolic view. So it's like making parables, like Jesus spoke. That's a perfectly Christologically authenticated, respectable point of view of interpretation. And the gestation point of view uses all three of them again to try and get the best in interpretation. It uses the historical critical method, it uses the Jewish Midrash method, it uses the literal, and it uses the parabolic. Are you with me?
Yes.
Right, number three. Going very fast, I hope. The language of the book of Revelation. Revelation chapter 1 verse 1 says he sent and communicated it. He sent and literally, I've got the word there for you, signified it. Signified it. It's the word sign which is used in John's gospel to say this sign. And then he did the first of his signs and showed his glory. The sign is something that is pointing towards something else. The sign is a symbol that points to something else. So you could say he sent and symbolized it. Now, please, from verse 1 of the book of Revelation, I don't want to argue about the thing or argue the case over much. Surely you realize it now. You've listened to me interpret the Bible enough. The beginning of the book of Revelation itself reminds us and warns us and says, don't forget, language is all to do with signs, and these are the signs that are coming to you. He didn't say you've got to be mathematically literalistic in before you can understand it, because nobody talks like that. We talk in parables, we talk in signs, we talk in symbols. Jesus did. So don't forget that when we come to the book of Revelation. I think I may have told you on some other occasion there were two great expositors of the 19th century who started off, and one of them gave a Bampton lecture, which is a theological lecture given at Cambridge every year, and he gave his lecture on seeking to interpret the book of Revelation as literalistically as possible. And then he later abandoned this viewpoint and he wrote a whole book upon the symbolism of Scripture. Because as years went on and the more he studied, the more you just cannot do it. It does not make sense. You can't make it literalistic as all that. It's a language which is right speaking in signs and in symbols. His name has slipped me for the moment. And then there was the wonderful interpreter called Andrew Jukes. Andrew Jukes wrote on the offerings, he wrote on the tabernacle. He was in the heyday of Brethrenism. He got thrown out of the Brethren because it was the heyday of Brethrenism. Because he wouldn't break bread more than once a month, and some silly thing like that. And that's the way they carried on in those days. But he, in his wonderful writings, also began by trying to interpret Revelation as literalistically as possible, and then gave up and wrote a book on the typology of Scripture. So just bear that in mind. As you get older, you should get a little wiser, perhaps not an awful lot, but perhaps a little bit. And these two great expositors both moved into a position whereby they were using, realizing that the book of Revelation is written in signs and symbols. So, moving on fast, I've just given you some other models. You could say that the model of the cartoon is there, the cartoons that you get in papers. You know, obvious one that you get the Prime Minister or the President or whoever he is, and he's drawn with a huge big head. You know it's him because his ears are sticking out, and that everybody knows him that way. And so the symbol of the cartoon is saying an awful lot more than you could say. Well, you have to write paragraphs to explain it all, but you immediately get it in the cartoon kind of symbolism. That's one way you could look at the book of Revelation, that it's written that way. You know that nice gent with a sweet seraphic smile who is the emperor of Rome. In actual fact, there's a fiend underneath that facade. And so I'm not going to paint him as a photograph with a nice literal face, but I'm going to paint him with an ugly, great, you know, seven-headed monster or whatever it is to get over what really he's like in truth, because it's truth that we want from the Bible. And that's one way. Another way you could talk about it as dream imagery. In dreams you get loads of symbolism. It's just like having a dream. Book of Revelation is like having trauma, like having a nightmare, and some people think. Not quite as bad as that, but it is dream imagery. And I've given some illustrations for you to look up. Or, if you like, you're caught up into the heavens, you're in the throne room of God. This is where the headquarters of the war is going on. And you've got a huge map on the wall. You've got little flags. The flags represent different battalions and different armies, and you're moving them around. Sometimes you put the pin in because you say, we are going to advance tonight into this strategic point, and you stick the pin in there. So it's depicting something for the future. On the other hand, you look around the maps, but that's where the troops advanced last week, and there the enemy is sitting down here, and you've got a pin down there with a little flag and some scarlet harlot or somebody sitting on it to depict who it is that's down in that corner. You got any idea? So it's like a war map in the headquarters of the battle. Number four, the book of Revelation compared to the Old Testament, the principles of interpretation, we're going into them at great detail here from all sorts of different angles. But if you go to the book of the Old Testament, when you talk about the day of the Lord, it always refers, or nearly always anyway, to something going to happen tomorrow or the next week or the week after that. But at the same time, it's opening the door. Before you know where you are, you're talking about the day of the Lord, when the same judgment is going to fall on the whole of humanity. Not just a town in Israel, but the whole of humanity is going to be judged. So you move from the day of the Lord to the day of the Lord. And so you get an immediate application of the prophecy, and you get a futuristic foretelling of the way that things are going to be. So the immediate and the local, the future and the worldwide. That's why you can say, I come quickly, because in some senses you are coming quickly. The next turn would be an awful long time, but day with the Lord is 1,000 years, and it seems a long time we've been waiting for the second coming. Shortly come to pass. It's that immediacy of the Lord's presence in the day of the Lord. Fifthly, the date of the book of Revelation. The popular date I've already mentioned is Domitian's reign, 81 to 96. But rather, that's when there was a bit of a resurrection of the of emperor worship. And some people argue it can't be the earlier date because certain statements made about earthquakes and whether cities existed or not. I think, though, nonetheless, there's a better case for the fact that it was during the days of Nero. Nero's just murdered himself, and therefore their great myth was rising up. Is he really dead? Can he really be dead? You can't get rid of evil people just as easily as that. Have you noticed how difficult it is to get rid of evil people? Rasputin, they gave him arsenic, they laced his cakes with arsenic, they beat him with chains, they tied weights around him and threw him in the river, but he still came back. Evil is very hard to get rid of, and so was Nero. Eventually he goes, and so the myth arose that he can't really be dead, he's coming back again, he's going to lead the armies of Persia right across into the Roman Empire and take it back again. Well, that lies behind some of the statements of the Book of Revelation. So our first century understanding helps us to think, what kind of a man is this? Well, is somebody who's going to be a parody. He's going to be a mockery, a parody of the death and resurrection of Jesus. He looks as though he's dead, but he's come back again. You know, that's the sort of thing that lies behind it. Well, now, with a modest 10 minutes left, if you turn the page over to the four vision structure, this is so very, very, very important. If you're going to see the complete and the wholeness of the Book of Revelation to get its message, you're not going to get it by proof texting, pulling out a verse here and pulling out a verse there. There is very clearly an introduction, the communication of Christ, which runs, let me divide it up for you. There are four places in the Book of Revelation, and this fourfold structure is terribly important to get hold of, where it says, I was in spirit, or I was in the spirit, because they didn't use the definite article called quiet lad as we do. I was in spirit, I was in the spirit, four times. Get a nice red pencil, find the four places and mark them carefully, and you would have begun to have got some reasonable approach to understanding the contents of 22 chapters. You've now broken them down into four tranches of revelation. But of course, like every good book, there's an introduction and a conclusion. Bearing in mind that these little phrases, I was in spirit and whatever it is, you'll see how they all tie up together. First, the communication of Christ, chapter 1, 1-8, he sent and signified by his angel to his servant John. Final conclusion, that's chapter 22, verses 6-21, that's where there's the call of Christ, the Spirit and the Bride say come, and that's the call of Christ into service, into obedience, until he comes again. So this is all C's. You can see how much labour has gone into getting all these C's. Must admit, I got a few from somebody else. The communication of Christ, the call of Christ. In the middle, four sections, each beginning with, I was in spirit. In vision one, or section one, I should say, each one of the four sections has a vision of Jesus. The first vision, you know very well, I turned and I saw the Son of Man in the midst of the churches, had a sword in his mouth, and his feet were as bronze, and his face shone as the sun. You know all of that. So you've got the vision, and there is a sword in the mouth of Jesus. The second section has a vision of Jesus, this time chapters 4 and 5, and there we see it's the Lamb in the midst of the throne. The Lamb in the midst of the throne. The third section, which is that's the biggest one, is the second. The third section, running from chapter 17, verse 1 to 21, verse 8, the third vision has the Lord coming with a sword, and the sword of his mouth that destroys his enemies. He's coming again for his bride, and to collect his bride, to take her, to reign with him, and to be with him. And this is what dominates the third section. I should have pointed out to you that the first two sections began with a trumpet. And the trumpet called, first of all, John to turn round, and then the trumpet called him into heaven. This time, it is an angel which had one of the bowls of wrath, which we've met in chapter 16. And she, whatever you call an angel, comes to with a bowl of wrath and introduces the third section. I will show you the harlot, and so on and so forth. And that's how the third section begins. So there's a tremendous great care has gone into putting this picture into place, because the next section's going to begin with an angel with a bowl of wrath, coming along and introducing, you've guessed it already, of course, not just simply as we've had already these two pictures of Christ with a sword in his mouth, but another picture of him being a lamb on the midst of the throne. So the fourth section is seeing Jesus as a lamb. So perhaps if somebody reads the chapter 21, verse 9, and he carried me away in spirit. Sorry, I should have read that. To a great and high mountain. This is the fourth occasion, dividing off the fourth section, and it begins equally again as to one who had one of the bowls, one of the angels. So we've got trumpet, trumpet, angel with bowl, angel with bowl. We've got a picture of sword in the mouth, lamb, sword in the mouth, lamb. Okay? And in this particular section, it's the lamb seven times. You'll see from verse 9 through to verse chapter 22, verse 5. The fourth section has got the lamb seven times, if you look carefully, because that is the predominant view. You are looking for, she says, I'll show you the bride. And as you look at the bride, you see the lamb in the midst of the bride, as it were, right in the midst of the city of Jerusalem. And she showed me he showed me the city coming down out of heaven. And there was about the lamb in the middle of it all. So you see lamb everywhere. I mean, you couldn't get a more carefully constructed book, could you? Are you hearing me? This is not a crazy mixed up loads of verses. You read some commentaries, they talk about, well, scissors and paste, you know, scissors, cut out a bit there and I'll stick that in there, and oh, I've got another bit over here, that's a nice bit of purple writing, I'll stick this here. That is not how this book came into being. And yet, well-meaning and erudite people talk about the construction of the book like that. Once you've begun to see the patterns there, I don't know how people could talk like that, but some of the most erudite commentaries just completely ignore the fact that it's so carefully put together. It's even better than we've seen so far. I've called that Christ coming in consummation. Consummation can either be pronounced consummation, and that is to consume, to eat up, to burn up, or consummation, which is to sum up. And I mean it, of course, in summing up. Christ coming and summing everything up into himself. So everywhere you look in the New Jerusalem, it's all called Lamb. The whole section is the whole vision. The vision now fills the whole of the section, because the vision is of Christ filling everything. So he better fill section 4. He fills everything, and this time he's called a lamb again. Okay? This time it is the lamb everywhere, the omnipresence of God, the omnipresence of heaven on earth. So we had first section, Christ imminent, close to us in persecution on earth. Secondly, Christ transcendent in heaven. Third section, Christ imminent, bringing heaven to earth, coming again. Third section, Christ filling everything, the fullness of him that fills all in all. The consummation when everything is headed up into Christ, Ephesians 1:10. And in two of them he's a lamb, in two of them he's got a sword in his mouth. So you saw vision 1, sword, vision 2, lamb, vision 3, sword, vision 4, lamb. You got that? Everybody happy? We're going to find in a minute that each of the visions also presents the throne of God, that is God's authority, of course, presents the throne of God in a different way. In the first one, the throne of God appears as, you will sit down with me in my Father's throne, as I overcame and sat down in my Father's throne. The second vision section shows and presents the throne of God, this time as the throne of government. As all the elders take off their crown, or they'd fall off anyways, but they all fall down and they worship. And you've got the throne which is governing the whole of the earth, because the Spirit, the seven spirits of God going out from the throne, go into all the earth. And you can see how God is governing the whole earth as a governor or prime minister or whatever you term of government you like to use, or as a king. The third section has the vision of Christ coming with a sword on his thigh, and this time the throne doesn't occur until you get to nearly the end anyway. And there in chapter 20 we've got the great white throne, and everything about the great white throne is it's a judgment throne or a judicial throne. It's quite different again. The Father's throne, the governmental throne, the judgment throne, or and you're into the law courts and weighing up lives. The great white throne of God, the great assize is taking place. And then finally, when you get to the book of into the fourth section, where the Lamb is seen sitting on the throne, it's the throne of God and the Lamb, and it's clearly the throne of the Emperor of the Empire. It's the Imperator's throne, the Imperial throne, that governs over the totality of creation, which has been brought back under God's jurisdiction. Now, I didn't put those thrones in, but it just confirms again for you the validity, the authenticity of this structure, which I don't know how anybody can really dare start to interpret Revelation without recognizing this structure. Now look how I've named in the section 1 Christ central in the church, because the Lamb is in the Creator's throne, in the midst of the throne. I call it the governmental throne, but it's the Creator governor. If you're the Creator, you govern it. And there's the Lamb in the midst of the throne there. Then you get to the end of that section. Oh, sorry, I missed out the sevens, didn't I? Look, there are seven churches in section 1. There are seven seals broken, seven trumpets, seven signs. Only three are actually called signs, but there are seven of them if you look carefully. And there are seven bowls. More of that in a minute. When you get to the third section, you've got seven, you could call them entities, persons, or significant entities. You've got a bride, you've got the harlot, you've got the bridegroom, you've got the Antichrist, you've got the city of Jerusalem, you've got the city of Babylon. And in the middle, added to it all, you've got Satan. Those are the seven entities that you get in that next section. Three of them are called signs, but it implies the others are signs as well, because they balance with each other anyway, whatever. So here we are with seven sevens, and you get to the end. The Lamb is mentioned seven times in that last section, which is also the last vision. It's the totality of the vision. And seven times it says, the Lamb, the Lamb, the Lamb, the Lamb, the Lamb. Heaven is full of Lamb. And everywhere you look, it's lamb-like. But not mean say meek and mild. It does mean that the Lamb is the governing principle of all that takes place there. Are you with me? Well, now jump down to part B. Look how the four sections are woven together, not only by the symmetry of ideas, which I've already demonstrated to you, sevens, aspects of the throne, swords. This is just to emphasize the careful structure again, and how they've all been carefully woven into one another. The first begins with Christ down here on earth below. And then the messages that are given to the churches are all about overcoming. To him that overcomes, to him that overcomes, to him that overcomes, to him that overcomes. Well, how do you overcome? Chapter 3, if you would just turn back there now, and verse 20, Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in to him and will dine with him and he with me. So there's a door opened on earth and the Lord comes in. He that overcomes, I will grant to him to sit down with me on my throne, as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne. He that has an ear to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. And the overcoming is Christ in us. And Christ coming into us and living in us we find that we're able to live as God intended us to. But then it says, immediately after, chapter 3 runs into chapter 4, and in chapter 4 it says, I saw a door opened in heaven. But I've just been opening a door here on earth. He that opens the door, I will come in. But now there's a door open in heaven. To those who open the door to Christ on earth, the door is open in the heavens. That's the way it works. The other side of the door, if you like. You let him in, he lets you in. And we go up into the heavens. A door was opened in heaven. I heard the voice like a sound of a trumpet speaking, saying, come up here, I will show you things that must take place after these things. Immediately I was in spirit, behold, a throne. And then the door you open here on earth, you'll sit with me in my throne. Now we look up, oh, there's a throne up there. And that throne up there is the throne of the Creator Governor, or the Creator Prime Minister, whatever you want to say. So there is the throne, having overcome. But who is in the throne? The one that overcame. Jump over into the second part of this vision, chapter 5, and you'll see in verse 6, and I saw between the throne, or in the throne, with the four living creatures and the elders standing, a lamb, as it were, having been slain, with seven horns, seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. And he came and took it out of the right hand of him that sat on the throne. And the golden bowls, verse 8, are full of the incense. And they sing a new song. What do they sing? Worthy are you to take the book and to break its seals, for you were slain and did purchase for God out of your blood from every tribe, tongue, people, nation, and you've made them a kingdom of priests to our God, and they will reign upon the earth. And that is a description of verse 5, where it says, the lion from the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has overcome to open the book. In chapters 2 and 3, it's overcome, 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 finish of it. I've overcome, so you can overcome if I come into you. And if I come into you, there's a door open in heaven. Come up to heaven where I am. And there, in the heavens with Christ, we see him as seated in the throne. Why? Because he overcame. He overcame and sat down in the throne. So straight away, we've got, if you like, the knot being tied between the two sections. You can't pull them apart. Say this one's gone in the wrong place. Because the door opened on earth, the door opened in heaven. I've overcome and sat in my Father's throne. Oh, there's one who's overcome and sitting in the throne of the Creator. And we're up there with him. In spirit. Some versions translate a different word there and they put had the victory or something like that. But it completely loses the whole flow of it. Seven overcomers flow into the churches and out, that opening the door into heaven, and there's the overcoming Lamb in the throne. And we're taken, as it were, to be there with him and engage with him in government, as we shall see as we go along. So, overcomers, door and throne, next section on your notes or up there on the screen, door and throne and overcomers. That is, Christ who is overcome and taking the prayers of the saints into the throne room so that we might be overcoming too. This time Christ is above, Christ below, Christ above. And this leads to judgment. And when you're up there with the overcomers, you start to see things working out on earth. Because when you get to the end of the second section, if you will turn, this is the biggest one of course, to chapter 16, having gone through seven seals, seven trumpets, seven signs, seven bowls. You'll know them by the end of the afternoon. We get to chapter 16, and this is the sort of climax. What is the climax? Verse 17, the seventh angel poured out his bowl upon the air. And a loud voice came out of the temple from the throne, saying, it is finished. It is done. And there were flashes of lightning and sounds of peals of thunder, and there were great earthquakes, as has not been since man had been upon the earth, so great an earthquake, and it was so mighty. And the great city was split into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell, and Babylon the great was remembered before God, to give her the cup of the wine of his fierceness of his wrath. And every island fled away, and the mountains were not found, and huge hailstones, about 100 pounds each, came down from heaven upon men, and men blasphemed because of the plague of hail, because this plague was severe. That is the, if you like, judgment on this great city of Babylon. That's the seventh bowl, and it was cast down. So that's where the second section ends. Door and throne, overcomers, ruling, getting things done on earth until it reaches the judgment of Babylon. But where do we begin in the third section? Well, we begin with the judgment of Babylon. One of the angels with a vial of wrath comes to me and says, do you want to see the great whore? Do you want to see Babylon the Great? Written across a mystery, Babylon the Great. And so the judgment of Babylon is then expanded from just its brief mention at the end of section 2, and in the beginning of section 3, in chapter 17 and 18, it is expanded beyond all expectation. The inner spirit, the harlot of Babylon, the outer forms and structures of the merchants and the shipmasters and so on, and Babylon is brought to its doom, to its judgment. So far, you can see it's like a jigsaw puzzle. It all knits together. You become overcomers like I'm sat in my Father's throne. Vision, oh, I am there in my Father's throne. You come up there and be overcomers with me. We'll bring about the judgment of Babylon. It's come about through the heavenly court. Now the judgment's taken place. We'll just examine it a bit more closely. And so we'll open up that judgment in its fullness. So although we've got three clear distinctions, all beginning with I was in spirit four times, so far all those three have been interlocked together. And so you can't pull them apart. Can't shift them or change them around. After the marriage of after the judgment of Babylon, in contrast, the marriage comes up in the third section. And there's the bride being collected by the bridegroom. We've got the millennium, we've got the great white throne, and the final doom of the universe, in a sense, or its salvation. But it finishes with the New Jerusalem. Because if you turn to chapter 21, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth passed away, and there's no longer any sea. And I saw the holy city, the New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven, made ready as a bride adorned for a husband. And all these final things, he that overcomes will inherit all things. Verse 9. The fourth section begins as one of the seven angels comes, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And we see a city. So having brought us to the conclusion, in verse 8 of chapter 21, we start the next section with, just like with the harlot that was examined in depth, so now we're going to examine the bride in depth, the city of Jerusalem. And so the new Jerusalem is expanded, just as Babylon was expanded. And that knits that third section to the fourth section, so it can't get away. You've got a very consistent and logical and coherent picture. The communication is the call of Christ, and then the first section where you've got Christ walking around amidst the lampstands, I've called it Christ Below. In the next one, where we've got Christ in the throne of the government, of the Creator's government, we've got Christ Above. In the third one, where we've got Christ riding out on a horse from heaven to earth, to collect his bride, I've called it Christ Descending. And then the final bit, Christ All in All, because everywhere you look in the New Jerusalem, it's full of Christ. And the conclusion, it's the call of Christ, that's right. So do you see how absolutely impossible it is to understand this book until you've begun to see this kind of pattern? That will help you to interpret within the biblical parameters and not out of the fantasies of our own overly fervent and overly feverish imagination. Now, in each of those four sections, there is a picture of a throne. I've compared it to the throne of our good queen. Be blessed forever. She has a house in Windsor Castle and a throne there. And the second place she has a throne is in Parliament. When she opens Parliament, she sits there in the throne, and ministers sit around. She has a third throne that she never sits in, which is somebody sits there for her in the Old Bailey, the judicial throne. And finally, she's got a throne in Buckingham Palace, the Empress's throne. Look how they correspond to the four sections thrones which we have in the book of Revelation. In section 1, in chapter 3, the vision of a throne is the throne of the Father. We've seen it already. Verse 21, he that overcomes, I will grant to him to sit down with me on my throne, as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne. And that's how we see Jesus in chapter 5 sat on his Father's throne, which presumably is also his throne. And he has an ear to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. That's the first picture of a throne. The second throne is the one we see in chapters 4 and 5, where we've got the government of the universe, and we've got the cabinet ministers and the ambassadors and so on and so forth, the governmental throne. In the third section, the throne is the great white throne, and you see that in chapter 20. I saw, verse 11, I saw a great white throne. That's the judgment throne, and he that sat upon it. And in chapter 22, we've got, he showed me the river, the water of life, clear as crystal, coming from the throne of God and the Lamb. Mentioned again in verse 3, the throne of God and the Lamb shall be in it. That's like Buckingham Palace, where the Queen sits as Empress over the Isle of Man and the Isle of Wight, a once great empire having disappeared. And you'll find a throne there. So there are four thrones in the four sections, and they all represent different aspects of God's authority. That's another way to show how it's all so carefully constructed to put over four different aspects of God's authority. And those are the things that the hostility and the rebellion of the world rises up against. We don't want a father's throne, so we destroy fatherhood, we destroy God being a father and having born again children and so on. We'll destroy the governmental throne and cause a lot of chaos. And so we don't want people reigning with him or using his authority. But there is no morality, there's no justice, there's no judgment. And the throne of judgment is going to come. And finally, that the Lord might be king over all the universe, not just the earth, over the whole of his empire, or we have in the end of the book. So, what else can I rapidly throw at you before we conclude? This is section number 2, God's frustrated plan outworked through the Lamb, who is now breaking the seals. He breaks 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7th seal. At the 7th seal, 7 trumpets begin. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 trumpets. And then in the 7th trumpet, the signs are appearing. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 signs. And then the last sign, then the bowls are poured out. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 bowls. It's possible there's meant to be seen a parallel with Leviticus 26, with a lot of sevens there. But it's much more likely that it's just to give a literary impression of things speeding up. You could read into it, but it would go something like this. Oh, the Lamb's now offering the prayers of the saints, and he's taken the book, he's broken the first seal, and now he's breaking the second seal, and this is happening. But then you, oh, he's broken the seventh seal, and the trumpets are beginning, and there's one trumpet, and another trumpet, and another trumpet, and now he's opened up the seventh trumpet, and there is sign after sign after sign after sign, and now we've got the bowls, and certainly with the bowls they go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 at a terrific speed as the wrath of God is being poured out. So perhaps it's meant to heighten the tension as we are reaching the end point. of the whole process. There are lots of other sort of little bits and pieces here that might have been helpful if we had time, but these are the seals as they're broken in that main section. White horse, red horse, black horse, yellow, green horse. After the horses, I put a little cross, and then three more. Souls under the altar, heavens pass, moon to blood, interlude, read the church, silence, and then the seven trumpets begin. Notice that there are lightnings, rumblings, and thunders, and that occurs at the very beginning, at chapter 4, verse 5, and when we enter into the seven trumpets, these are the trumpets. Don't forget the little cross there. Here they come again.
Don't forget the cross now.
Hail, fire, blood, wormwood stars, sun, moon, stars. There's the cross again. And because those first three obviously all go together. But the next lot, locust, horseman, and then an interlude with the church again, and then the kingdom of our Lord and Christ. This time, we've got lightnings, rumblings, thunders, and earthquake. That begins with the trumpets. I've called that demonic. Then this next one, you're still there. You've got sores, sea, blood, founts, fire as the bowls are poured out. Then a little cross, because the next ones are different. Throne, Armageddon, interlude of the church again, Babylon destroyed. This time it's lightnings, rumblings, thunders, earthquake, and plague of hailstones. Getting more and more intense as you run through, all coming out of the throne of God. Well, the bowls, I would suggest, are showing the divine reaction to sin. That's God's wrath poured out. The trumpets are releasing the demonic forces in the earth. The seals are human political movements on the earth, by and large. And the sights or the signs are spiritual evidences of what God is doing in the world spiritually. So they all have a particular emphasis. I've also, I think, on your notes, where are your notes, given you a point about the date, have I? That I think it was Neronian persecution. You'll find the majority of commentaries suggest that this was written in AD 94 or thereabouts, when Domitian began a very specific persecution. It wasn't a worldwide persecution, really. It was against certain aristocrats in the Roman government and with the Roman aristocratic families who had turned to Christ. And he was purging them and bringing back emperor worship. And that's why various people, Achilles, Gabriel, Flavius Clemens and Domitilla, in some way or other, either were executed or banished from the land. So it wasn't a full-blooded persecution. Whereas in the days of Nero, it was the first great state attack on the church and was very bloody. And there are hints that there are allusions to the fact that everybody thought Nero, when he'd committed suicide, was going to come back again. Couldn't get rid of an evil man just as easily as that. And the Nero reliving Redivivus myth is incorporated in the book of Revelation, because the fear that evil is so evil that it always comes back. And that's there. And the three emperors, one after another, in about 1 year, year and a half, that's hinted at in the horns on the beast. And various allusions like this. I like to think of it actually much more realistically, when John was still fairly fit and well and was in exile, true enough. But by the time we get to the 90s, John would probably be, well, at least 80 or so, 70, 80. Could have written it, of course, but I think it fits much better if we see it just after the Neronian persecution, and that would be about after 69 to 70. Vespasian came to the throne, and then I think this was possibly written then.